dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has rendered huge service and continuing service, I'm pleased to say, in the course of that war, particularly in the intelligence space, is our friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, its president and CEO, Fred Flights. He is, as listeners to this program know well, a career intelligence professional, having served in the Central Intelligence Agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, for some 20 years. Also serving on the professional staff of the House Intelligence Committee and as the chief of staff to Ambassador John Bolton, initially when he was Undersecretary of State, and then as the National Security Advisor to the President. Fred, I do want to just note, has now been publicly bruited by the press, and in one instance, the President himself, as a candidate for not one but two senior positions in the United States government, that of the Director of National Intelligence, and most recently as a prospective successor to the man he worked with, Ambassador John Bolton, as the National Security Advisor to President Trump. Fred Flights, quite a repertoire there. Thank you very much. Your service to our country, past and present, and hopefully continuing, will be as much appreciated. Let me ask you, you've written a piece in the National Review, Fred, just yesterday, about the kinds of critical tasks the next Director of National Intelligence is going to have to contend with. Could you walk us through some of those key tasks as you see it?
Well, Frank, it's good to be here. It's been a crazy week. There's really important stuff that has to be done in the intelligence community. I think not just improving intel, but noting that there are real challenges with emerging technologies, which is giving up. Not just rogue states and terrorist groups, but disgruntled individuals an opportunity to do an enormous amount of damage with drones and cyber attacks that, frankly, I don't think our country or our intelligence community are ready to deal with. I also talked about not only should we defend the integrity of the 2020 elections, but the community also has to face up to the fact that intelligence was weaponized in 2016. Steps had to be taken to make sure that never happened to another presidential campaign. And that's going to take real leadership because the intelligence community does not want to admit that. But it is something that I think needs to be done. I mean, there are many, many Americans who are, I mean, look at Andy McCarthy's book on what happened in 2016 and how intelligence was weaponized.
Well, when you talk about intelligence being weaponized, you're not talking about Russian intelligence. You're talking about U.S. intelligence being weaponized against a candidate for the presidency, namely Donald Trump.
Exactly. And, you know, it's becoming harder and harder to deny that this happened. And I'm not calling for intelligence officials to go on a witch hunt to name names. I just think rules have to be in place to make sure that this never happens again. Basically, if there's ever a reason to conduct such investigations against campaign personnel, there probably should be congressional notification and very, very high standards before this happens. This is something that should be accepted on a bipartisan basis. I don't think it will be, but I believe this is a priority for the president.
Rightly so. And Fred, you're very familiar, of course, having been both in the intelligence community and part of the oversight of that committee on the House Intelligence Committee staff. That congressional reporting requirement is one of the real checks on abuses, or at least it's supposed to be. And as you say, it should be supported, this proposal of yours, on a bipartisan basis. Why would it not be?
You know, I think the rules are sort of vague with this type of investigation. It sort of seems logical that there should be congressional notification. And I think, you know, if the officials wanted to make sure that they had the impression of being fair and balanced and non-biased, they would do that. I don't think that was their intention in 2016. But right now, I think we have to make it clear that there should be notification before these investigations start.
Fred, you mentioned these asymmetric threats that are emerging and that are really new challenges, not just to our intelligence community, for heaven's sakes, but to the national security capabilities of this country writ large. And just to look at one of those, the use of drones or perhaps even cruise missiles by the Iranian regime to attack key oil facilities in Saudi Arabia has had devastating effects, of course, on those facilities and on the output of Saudi energy supplies. But talk us through what we're likely to see. The United States government, Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, has gone off to Saudi Arabia to talk about all this with the Saudis and presumably others in the region. What kind of things would we be talking about with them, do you think? Is this looking both at the assessment of what happened in the event and as well as presumably what kind of response is underway now or should be?
Well, the president is first checking his options. He's looking at the intelligence. He's consulting with our allies. But I think there will have to be a rather robust military response. Otherwise, Iran would just be emboldened to do this again. The key thing is, what do the Saudis want? I mean, they have to declare this an act of war, and they have to take a leading role in responding. You know, there's a lot of concern that we have to stop being the policemen of the world, and why are we defending an act of war against another state? And those are serious questions that we have to ask, and I believe that's something that Mike Pompeo is talking to the Saudi leadership about right now. We've sold billions of dollars of military hardware to the Saudis, and they have to play a significant role, if not a leading role, in any military response to what was really an act of war by Iran. These missiles were fired from Iranian soil. They were probably cruise missiles against Saudi territory. This was an act of war by one nation state against another.
Yeah. I don't know how you could call it anything else. And that does, in fact, change the character of this conflict rather dramatically. Does it surprise you? You've spent most of your professional career trying to assess what the Iranians were up to, the capabilities that they were amassing, often covertly. Does this shock you? And if you find this at least a dramatic escalation, as it obviously is, what do you think prompted it?
This really represents a desperation by the Iranians to the president's successful maximum pressure campaign. And it really surprised me that the Patriot missile batteries were not prepared to defend these critical oil facilities. They were pointed southward instead of defending from the east. But basically, the U.S. did not think there would be Iranian attacks against these facilities. They only assumed there would be attacks by the Yemeni Houthi rebels.
Yeah. A critical shortcoming, and one that we need to make sure is addressed among other aspects of the Saudi infrastructure that need to be protected. Fred Flights, as always, thank you for your insights and your clarity on these points, and congratulations on your consideration for these very important posts. We're very proud of you and look forward to talking with you next week. Next up, we will speak with Gordon Chang about the latest developments in Hong Kong and elsewhere with respect to communist China. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. I'm pleased to say, joined as we have the privilege of being just about every week, by Gordon Chang. I consider him to be one of America's preeminent experts on matters in Asia, and most especially China. And he has addressed this subject handsomely in countless articles and press interviews, but also in three really important books on Asia topics more generally, but China as well. The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and most recently, an Encounter Books publication, Losing South Korea. We'll be talking about much of that with him in the course of this segment. Gordon, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Frank.
You are on the board of an organization I value, the American Conservative Union, Gordon, and you and its chairman and executive director, respectively, Matt Schlapp and Dan Schneider, were in Hong Kong recently and met with leaders of the opposition to what the Chinese Communist Party is trying to do there. Give us an update on what you saw on the ground and what America should be doing about it.
You know, we talked to a number of people in Hong Kong. This was a fact-finding trip. And what we learned, essentially, is the determination of the young protesters. And even more important, their humanity. We went to a number of demonstrations. I only went to one, but Matt and Dan went to others. And what we saw really was the coalescing of society against Carrie Lam, the Hong Kong chief executive, the top political official, as well as deep concern across Hong Kong about the excessive force of the Hong Kong police. We actually saw the Hong Kong police in action, and there's a lack of discipline there, and it's being worn down. This is a real concern because Hong Kong society is deteriorating. You can see the loosening of the social bonds. And clearly right now we have people fighting for their homes. The United States needs to be there, needs to support the protesters. And it's largely because we have a common foe. China is trying to take away their autonomy and China's attacking our democracy. We've got to confront the Chinese. We should be doing it at every opportunity. And right now, the front line of freedom is not here. It's in Hong Kong.
There is an individual who has been at a very tender age of, I think, all of 22, one of the leaders of this so-called leaderless revolution in Hong Kong, Joshua Wong. I understand you met with him here in the States. Gordon, tell me what you made of him and his agenda.
Yeah, I'm Lydia, my wife and I met Joshua at a dinner party in New York on Saturday, along with several other people from Hong Kong. You know, Joshua Wong is absolutely fascinating. He was a leader in the 2014 Occupy Central protests. Right now, he is the face of Hong Kong protests, but he is not really involved in them, except going around to get support in the international community. And that, of course, is a critical function. So right now, you can say that Joshua Wong is certainly a controversial figure among the current Hong Kong protesters, but it's important that we support him as others. Because right now he is the one who people turn to and look to for comment and advice about the Hong Kong protests.
Good. Well, I hope to have him on our air, as a matter of fact. Gordon, let me turn to the fact that President Trump, of course, continues to hope that it might be possible to achieve a trade deal with China. As we've talked about, among other things, with Bill Gertz in connection with his terrific new book, Deceiving the Sky. The fact that trade is only one part of a much larger set of very serious challenges the United States is facing from the Chinese Communist Party. But what are your thoughts as this Chinese delegation returns to Washington soon to resume negotiations on what the president hopes will be a breakthrough?
I don't see a breakthrough, but then again, I don't have any visibility into the president's thinking. Really, right now, there are going to be these discussions, but the two sides are far apart. Of course, though, you have two willful figures, President Trump and Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler. They do meet in November. Who knows what could occur after the two of them sitting down in the same room. But we've got to remember that China has never, ever honored a trade deal with the United States. And so I don't think that an agreement is our way out of this. It certainly would help the Chinese. They've got a crumbling economy right now. They could use an accommodation, but we should not be giving it to them because this is just not in our long-term interest to help the Communist Party save itself. We've saved Chinese communism three times already. We should not engage in a fourth rescue of a regime that has identified us as the enemy. And not just internally, but also externally. As we've talked about before, Frank, in the middle of May, People's Daily identified us as the object of their people's war. And so, therefore, we've got to assume that they are doing everything possible to undermine us. Any sort of deal with them would be wrong.
Yeah. As you say, Gordon, it's not just that they are talking about us as the enemy. Their entire, well, unrestricted warfare agenda, the China dream, is focused on treating us that way and ultimately defeating us so they may achieve the kind of global supremacy that Bill has written about, as have you on any number of occasions. Let me switch gears, Gordon. One of the other topics that you've turned your attention to, notably with this latest publication at Encounter Books, Losing South Korea, is what is going on inside the government of Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, that compounds the problems that we're facing from China's puppet or proxy in North Korea. Tell us about this new justice minister that the president of South Korea has installed, what his background is, what his agenda is, and what that suggests may be in the offing in terms of, some sort of separate peace between North and South Korea and its implications for the rest of us.
Despite objections, Moon Jae-in, the president, has appointed Cho Kuk as the justice minister. Cho has been under investigation for corruption, and one of the first things that he has done as justice minister is to limit the public's right to know about the investigation of him. So this is really is quite stunning. There's a bigger issue, of course, or two bigger issues. One of them is Cho Kuk is certainly going to do his best to continue Moon's initiatives to undermine democracy and openness in South Korea. And Cho himself has a past of where he has espoused pro-North Korea views. So there's all sorts of sins here. This is extremely concerning. The one thing about South Korea is that, you know, we thought 2 weeks ago that the South's termination of the military sharing agreement, information sharing agreement with Japan, was a crisis. Well, this week we've got another crisis, which is Cho Kuk. God knows what's going to occur next week, Frank, but things are moving swiftly in the wrong direction. President Trump is going to meet with Moon. We need to have very frank conversations, not only in private, but also in public. Of course, we are loath to do that because South Korea is an ally. But we got to recognize that Moon, as you have talked about in the past, is trying to break the alliance with the United States. And that would be a problem for us because South Korea forms a part of our Western defense perimeter.
Yeah. And it does seem as though he is moving inexorably into the Chinese sphere in the process. And just a word about this breaking of the agreement with Japan. How big a deal is that, Gordon Chang?
Well, this is important from two points of view. First of all, whatever weakens our ability to defend North Korea is going to be a huge setback, and certainly it is. South Korea is taking actions, and this is what I find significant about it. South Korea is taking actions that vitally undercut its ability to defend itself because Japanese satellites are crucial in, first of all, identifying North Korea launches, and those launches are a direct threat not only to Japan but, of course, to South Korea. But it's a real indication that Moon does not want to cooperate with the United States in defense matters. And so it is a warning to us. You know, there is one other military sharing agreement that the two countries have. It's far less important than the one that Moon has just terminated. But nonetheless, things are moving very quickly in the wrong direction. Trump administration needs to understand that this is a crucial matter to the United States and step in into terms of trying to settle differences between Tokyo and Seoul. It's had a hands-off attitude. That was not the right way to go, especially given where things were going. I think that it's important for President Trump to directly intervene.
I do too, and I hope that the UN meeting with Moon may be the beginning of that opportunity. Let me ask you finally, Gordon, we haven't spoken, I don't think, since the president announced that he was calling off a meeting that no one knew was in the offing with the Taliban at Camp David. This is now part of the complicated diplomatic exercise that's underway there in Afghanistan, as well as the military situation on the ground. What are your thoughts, Gordon, especially with respect to the possibility that China may be one of the principal beneficiaries of any deal that we might strike with this Sharia supremacist group, the Taliban?
We shouldn't have been talking to the Taliban in the first place, certainly not in the United States at Camp David. The reason why we are in what looks like an endless struggle in Afghanistan is to make sure that Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, terrorist allies don't gain a safe haven, as they did in the run-up to 9/11. You know, we can argue about tactics, about the United States' commitment there, but the one thing we have done is prevent a large-scale terrorist attack since 9/11, in large part because of our presence in Afghanistan. So therefore, you know, we need to understand why we are there, even if victory seems to be so far away. It is because we need to make sure that no one gets that safe haven.
Right. Gordon, thank you so much for this quick tour de raison and your extraordinary and important portfolio, Asia. Come back to us again next week, if you would, sir, and thank you for all you do, my friend.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by the host of Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, a very important production of Blaze TV. You can find out how to subscribe to it at economicwarroom.com. Kevin is also the author of two superb books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. He blogs at globaleconomicwarfare.com, and he is just a fantastic contributor to our program each week, and we are so grateful to him for that, as well as for being a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy. Kevin, it's always good to have you with us. Thank you for doing it today.
Always good to be with you, Frank.
You made a signal contribution last week, Kevin, to the latest threat briefing that we put on under the banner of the Committee on the Present Danger, China. People can find your video clip as well as those of other participants at presentdangerchina.org. But I wanted to talk with you because this really does seem to me to be a prime example, the topic of that program, a prime example of economic warfare as it is being practiced by communist China these days. Talk to us about what's going on in terms of their use of our capital markets to underwrite their malevolence against us.
Well, essentially, Frank, we're funding both sides of this war, economic war. It's very familiar. We used to be funding both sides of the war on terror with high oil prices and importing so much oil. Fortunately, we've had a solution on that side. But on this one, the Chinese have figured out how to unlock American capital from hardworking, patriotic citizens, the military, government employees, retired employees, that in the thrift savings plan, they're able to tap that, put it in their companies, claim, you know, you're going to get these great investment returns, and then who knows where the money's going, because some of these companies are actually fraudulent. And it's happening. It will happen if the thrift savings plan approves an increase of the weighting to index funds, and then the index funds themselves have been manipulated to quadruple the weighting of Chinese holdings. So a huge amount of American money would be put into Chinese companies with no oversight, nothing we could do about it, and they could use that money against us.
Well, let's just make this a little bit more nuanced. The Morgan Stanley product, the MSCI index, now is doing that with some of their international indices. But Kevin, the thrift savings plan, which you alluded to there, that has the investment funds for the pensions of past as well as present government employees, veterans, and serving military personnel, is poised to begin mirroring those MSCI products and would have the kind of problematic consequences that you've just described. Fortunately, it hasn't happened yet. And one of the things that we're calling for with your help at the Committee on the Present Danger China is for that decision to begin putting those funds at risk of funding the enemy, including in building weapons to attack us with, is coming down the tracks in 2020. And that needs to be stopped.
Yep. So there's two problems. One is whether or not the thrift savings plan mirrors the indices. And the second one is whether the indices quadruple the weighting of Chinese holdings. Both of those are bad decisions.
And both are in the offing, folks. I particularly wanted to commend to our listeners, Kevin, in addition to your own terrific video contribution to that program, two other ones, one by Roger Robinson, a frequent guest on this program, who has done a lot of the spade work on what's going on in our capital markets in this regard, but also Chris Iacovella, who is the president and CEO of the American Securities Association. These are two important contributions to this public policy debate, and it's very important that particularly those of us who have our own funds in that thrift savings plan know what's going on and try to encourage its termination. Kevin, let me ask you about some other things that the Chinese are up to. Specifically, you've been warning on this program and elsewhere, including at Blaze TV, of course, about China's determined effort, and that of the Russians for that matter, to displace the United States dollar as the currency, the reserve currency of the world. What are the Chinese doing in that regard at the moment? And is there minting of a new cryptocurrency based on the yuan, their dollar counterpart, part of that larger effort as you see it?
Well, they've been active for now 6 years in removing the dollar. It became a stated official policy to de-dollarize the world and to de-Americanize the world starting 6 years ago, 2013. And yes, the idea that they're going to offer a digital version of the renminbi or the yuan is a part of that effort. And they're trying to slide it out as a cryptocurrency. Those who are actual cryptocurrency fans, and I'm not necessarily one of them, but those who believe in the cryptocurrency like the fact that it's anonymous. They like the privacy aspect. They like the fact that it's not government controlled. Well, the Chinese version will be the worst of all worlds. And yet it's being floated out there in such a way as to attract capital and say, look, we're advanced beyond America and you can trust us and you can have access to your funds and so forth. It will be rolled out domestically first, but they're using it, no question about it, as a means to establish the Chinese yuan as a primary global reserve currency and displace the dollar.
Yeah. Kevin, that's a tantalizing issue. Why would the Chinese cryptocurrency be the worst of all possible options?
Because it's government controlled. There would be no, it'd be fully in the hands of the government. They could ramp up or slow down the money supply as they saw fit. They could monitor every transaction. So if you have paper, Chinese paper yuan, and you want to go spend it, they're able to track you somewhat. If it's a digital currency, they track you 100%. There's no anonymity here. There's no privacy. There is complete control. And if you have it in a digital wallet and they just choose to remove it from your account, they can do it instantly. They can just, with a flip of a, you know, a press on the keyboard, and you have half the money that you thought you had. Whereas if you had paper currency, you actually have something. It is a higher level of control.
Well, that does sound pretty unappetizing, I have to say. And especially for people who think, you know, Bitcoin or some of these other digital currencies that are supposedly all about that kind of privacy and anonymity and exclusive control by the person who owns the wallet. It's the antithesis, really, isn't it? Just another Chinese flim-flam, I'm afraid. Let me turn to one other topic with you, Kevin Freeman, and that is there are clearly very profound economic implications arising from the attack by the Iranian government. Fred Flight says that it's pretty clear those missiles were launched out of Iran's own territory against key pieces of the oil infrastructure of Saudi Arabia. Give us a sense of what the repercussions might be of this attack and what we should be doing about it as you see it.
Well, in the first place, is that Iran is the most reasonable suspect. They stand to gain the most from it because of the conflict that they've had economically and socially and religiously with Saudi Arabia. The Iranian government needed higher oil prices. They've been working with the Chinese and getting investment. So they seem a very likely suspect. So that doesn't surprise me that Fred Flights believes that. Secondly, we should thank our lucky stars that we've allowed the American fracking and shale industry to develop here in the United States. There are politicians, particularly on the Democrat Party side, that have said we'll ban all fracking and the use of fossil fuels. If we did not have fracking, if we did not have our shale industry, gas prices could have spiked dramatically from that hit to the Saudi oil fields, and we would be extraordinarily vulnerable, and the Iranians would be tempted to do even more damage to the Saudi fields. But the truth is, America is the largest producer of energy, and we are now approaching the largest exporter of energy. We literally are the swing producer. We control the price with our production. And so the damage that was done was a fraction of what it would have been, even if they took about 5% of production offline, and some of it's come back. But if we were not producing oil, $5 a gallon gasoline would have been expected, and maybe $150, $200 per barrel oil, at least in a spike, and then that would tempt the Iranians and others to go further. But because we have a secure energy network here, we're able to protect the world as well as our own economy.
Right. Well, a secure energy network here is something that I think, Kevin Freeman, you have spent a lot of time concerned about, as have I. And one of the takeaways for me of this attack by the Iranians was not only that they were willing to do it, you know, with the possible costs that they would hopefully incur by such an action, by such an act of war, as Fred Flights put it, but we ourselves are highly susceptible to some kind of asymmetric attack as well, and that wouldn't apply just to our energy sector, but that would be among the places that would be hurt if, for example, there were an attack on our electric grid. And the North Koreans and the Chinese and the Russians and certainly the Iranians have, as you know, Kevin, a doctrine of using electromagnetic pulse or cyber means or perhaps even just physical sabotage to affect and perhaps even take down America's electric grid. Bless you, my friend. Thank you for the work you do with us at the Center for Security Policy, as well as the great, great material that you're producing at Blaze TV. Check it out at economicwarroom.com. Kevin, come back to us again soon if you would. Diana West joins us next. We'll talk with her about, well, the enemy within and the role the press is playing in propagandizing us for partisan purposes. That and more, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is one of the high points of our week to be able to speak with Diana West, one of the country's most thoughtful commentators and analysts and pundits, a longtime syndicated columnist. She blogs these days at dianawest.net. Her three terrific books are Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and most recently, The Red Thread. I commend all of them to you. One of the leitmotifs throughout them is the problem of the enemy within. And Diana West, first, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us again. It's great to have you back.
Oh, thank you. Wonderful to be back.
And secondly, you wrote at your blog this week about the race editor at the New York Times. And it got me thinking about more generally, especially in the aftermath of how appallingly the New York Times comported itself in connection with this latest attack on Justice Kavanaugh, that it's really just a political warfare instrument these days, the sort of red-green axis instrument of choice. But talk us through this question of why there's a race editor at the New York Times, and more generally, the service to which its editors are now putting their paper for purely political purposes.
Yes, well, you wonder what the people who actually put the paper out are thinking journalism is, because it's certainly the concept of presenting readers who want to pick up a paper with facts is absolutely not on their radar or part of their mission at all. And I think the Kavanaugh piece of it is just another one of these outrages, if indeed you believe journalism to be an array of facts, who, what, when, where, how, why, that is presented for people to sort of digest and talk about and debate and come to conclusions on their own, or reading opinion columns. I mean, that's fine. Opinions are fine in a newspaper so long as they are labeled. But what we're seeing in the Kavanaugh crisis, again, this weird deflection of our attention back to this utterly hideous campaign to smear the man without facts, is this notion of tearing down, creating in its place false realities. And this is where people are supposed to have emotional reactions and become hysterical and do the bidding of the left. I mean, this is essentially what we're looking at in terms of the role of the New York Times. And it's transparent at this point. But if people agree with the agenda, they're on board. So it's a terrible situation.
Yeah, terrible situation and terrible disservice, I think, to the American people. And, you know, one of the things, Diana, that going back to the founding, the framers of our Constitution, you know, were very intent on providing for freedom of the press in the conviction that it would be independent of government and an objective arbiter. There would be opinions, as you say, but they would be objectively presenting the facts in the parts of the press that were supposed to do that. And on that basis, you know, they were given wide protections and latitude, but it certainly seems as though it's no longer providing that check and balance on the powerful. It's instead now increasingly being put in the service of some, at least.
Yes, and I think just to make another point about this is you see them discussing their role, and this goes back to their creation of a race editor, their role in creating opinion, in interpreting for readers what is going on. I mean, they see themselves as the shaper of reality by taking the facts such as they are, omitting the ones that don't comport with their worldview, and then presenting that. And the Kavanaugh story this week, which did not have a factual basis, did not have witness fact certainty by in any part of the story of alleging these behaviors back at Yale in the 1980s, this is exactly how it is done. You take a little piece of that and a little piece of this and you whip it up and you present it. This is the lowest form of what was called yellow journalism, in terms of just being this emotional trigger that was not based in any kind of judicious editing and writing.
And going back to the race editor business, I mean, it is clearly now part of the agenda of the New York Times and others, the left more generally, clearly, to promote this whole meme of the country being awash with racism and white supremacism, and they have a dedicated editor to apparently promote that meme. But Diana, I wanted to pivot for a moment because it's not just the New York Times, alas. There is another paper of record, in some circles at least, the Washington Post. And I'm struck by the fact that the Post now, with great regularity, has in its front section an insert that is thinly identified, shall we say, as from China. It's an advertisement supplement, but it is, to be clear, full-on Chinese propaganda. And it's being pushed forward in a manner that could confuse the innocent, shall we say, to the Washington Post readership. We are subject to active political influence operations and disinformation and enemy propaganda. Just another example of the enemy within deceiving the sky. And I just wonder what your thoughts are about the role the Post is playing, as well as the New York Times in this regard.
Yes, well, this is another piece of it. And I think that what we can see in the Post's presentation of this Chinese Communist government propaganda insert is their own comfort level with doing so. I mean, this again goes to this notion of, you know, you can ask yourself, what totalitarian governments would they draw the line at? There are some. Looking over history, we can say, yes, we can maybe assume that they would not be presenting readers with Hitlerian Germany propaganda inserts. We can maybe say that. Going to the notion that, yes, they still have a discomfort level with such propaganda, giving them the best projection here. But looking to what they see as presentable, well, we know that on the left there is great affinity for Chinese, quote, achievements under communism. I mean, this is something we see Bernie Sanders on the campaign trail actually extolling Mao's great leap forward and some such in terms of his discussions of Chinese, quote, betterment of you know, communist Chinese betterment of the people's lives, not mentioning the fact that millions upon millions would lose their lives in these efforts. This is the kind of This is the dirty secret of the left itself, which the Post is a part of, that there is this great affinity for the communist idea. And it is not so much that they would condone the loss of life or the gulags, etc., but it is the idea itself that still has this tremendous attraction for the left, that is, and indeed, unfortunately, you know, sections of the right. This is something Vladimir Bukovsky writes about with great eloquence in his book Judgment in Moscow, this tragedy that people do not understand the idea of communism. It is what is inhuman about it, not the the manifestations of it in the gulag, in starvation, in war. These are manifestations of the inhuman idea, which still has its attraction in the Washington Post, across the Democratic Party. Every single candidate thereof running for president is attracted by the communist idea, and this is where we are. And so, it is an absolute, we're in absolute peril, because it is the idea itself that is still not rejected, you know, just across the board. And this is where we are. People don't understand it. They think, oh, well, I'm not for killing 10 million people in an act of government, but it is what inspired the government to do that. That is the problem.
The ideological underpinning of it, of course. And just in the interest of completeness, though we won't have time to discuss it in any length, Diana West, there is, of course, yet another force that is perpetrating similar kinds of propagandizing and subversion from within, and those would be what I call the Sharia supremacists. And we're seeing their hand strengthened and enabled by countries like Qatar and Turkey these days. And we actually have schools operated by this Turkish expatriate imam by the name of Fethullah Gulen that are indoctrinating our children. So I can't tell you how much I appreciate the work that you've done, particularly with American Betrayal and the Red Thread, Diana West, about this enemy within problem. It's one of the really important contributions you make to our program, and I look forward to you doing so again next week. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.